Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The year was 1973, and the Vietnam War had been met with countless protests, national unrest, and a call to end the military draft.
May 11th, May 1-1, 348, 348.
That was the often televised draft lottery, familiar to most at the time. It was one of the last military draft lotteries televised in March of 1973. President Nixon ended the draft, but the benefits of the all-volunteer operation that replaced it have been debated in the years since. Coming up, we'll talk to a retired major general who has written a book about the issue. Joining us now by phone is former Assistant Secretary of Defense Lawrence Korb. He is a senior fellow at American Progress and senior advisor to the Center of Defense Information and a retired captain in the Navy. Larry, welcome to the show.
Nice to be with you.
So those are some pretty fancy titles, but bottom line is you ran personnel for at the Pentagon during the Reagan administration.
Well, that's correct, yeah.
So can you go back and tell us how the all-volunteer military was conceived after the draft ended?
Well, when we set up the all-volunteer military, we did what we normally do. We had a commission, and it took Nixon set up the commission as soon as he came into office in 69, and they ended it. The last draft was in January of 1973. Then we went to a volunteer military, but it had three, if you will, parts to it. Number one, since when you went to a volunteer military, you're going to have to pay competitive wages. We kept the active duty force smaller than we had in the past. For example, when I came in, I got commissioned in the Navy, we made $200 a month. I mean, well, you know, that was in the 60s. You're not going to get too many people to volunteer for that. Then what we would do for the first time, we would ensure that the Guard and Reserve were fully resourced and that they had good equipment so that if you got into a conflict, you could call them up. Now, that was less expensive since Guard and Reserve people are not, you know, off on full time. And then the third component, which is often overlooked, we kept draft registration in case we got into a long, extended conflict that would require more people. And so those were the, you know, the three pillars that we set it up on. And it took us a while to get it right because what happened was when you started the volunteer military, people did not have a high opinion of the military like they do now because of Vietnam. And so it was hard to recruit. The military had no idea how to compete in the marketplace. When I came into government in 1981, I mean, the ads were, you know, I'm not an ad expert, but I'm thinking, good heavens, you know, one of the ads was today's Army wants to join you. You'd get the wrong people. And then, you know, they got better about it. And then I think President Reagan infused a new sense of patriotism in the country. And so we got it on the right track. And it worked very well in terms of the capabilities until and did great in the first Gulf War because that was short, did fine in Bosnia and the Balkans. But it really had tremendous problems after the prolonged conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the pros and cons and the history of the volunteer military in the United States with Lawrence Korb. He's a former Assistant Secretary of Defense. He ran personnel for the Pentagon back during the Reagan administration. Do you think that the volunteer system works? You can give us a call and tell us yes or no, 614-292-8513, and also tell us why. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. How did that transition affect the troops already in place at the time? Were there new regulations or training procedures and how you actually prepared the troops?
Well, see, what people forget, even when you had a draft, most of the people were volunteers because they'd only draft you for 2 years. And so people forget, they say, oh, you went to an all-volunteer force, like we completely changed. No, you still had, you know, the majority of people were volunteers.
Okay.
And what happened is, after a kind of the initial shock about, you know, what kind of standards did you need? I mean, for example, we did not know what a person getting a high school education, what then would be the probability of that man or woman being successful. It took us a while to figure that out. But most of the, in the beginning, we had a lot of problems. We got a lot of the wrong people. People were just meeting their quotas regardless of, who the people were. And that was disillusioning to what we call the non-commissioned officers, had to train these young men and young women. But once we got that straightened out and we figured out who should we recruit and get the people with the right education and right what we call, scores on the test coming in, then I think people were much happier because now you didn't have the impression that people being forced to be there, they wanted to be there. And I think that really did improve the morale tremendously in the service. But it took us about a decade to get that right.
What do we know about the demographics of the volunteer military, that is, outside of the military academies that groom most of the leadership and so forth?
Well, you got the demographics, and you're right. I mean, the officers' demographics are they're more of the, higher socioeconomic levels, as you might expect.
Mm-hmm.
For enlisted people, it's more people from rural areas, more people from the South and Southwest than you have, say, from New England or the upper Midwest. But what's happening, it's really becoming like a family business now since it's been in existence for 40 years. A lot of the young men and women, who join basically do, my dad was in there, my uncle, or, it's one of those, things, because that's how they are, in a sense, recruited, because, hey, it's, my dad was in there, he liked it a lot, so maybe I'll do it. And that, I think, is becoming, an important factor, which people didn't consider when they first set it up.
Well, what about recruitment? Is there any value placed on variety? I mean, on getting people from different socioeconomic levels, but certainly at least different geographic regions.
Well, to a certain extent, I mean, we've seen it with the officers, for example. Now that we dropped the ban on gays in the military, a lot of the Ivy League schools are now bringing back ROTC. So, that will help get people from, like Princeton and Yale, places mm-hmm. like that, and Columbia. So you will get people from different parts of the country. You do have your recruiting stations all over the country, but mm-hmm. obviously, it's like anything else. If I have a recruiting station, in downtown Boston, and nobody's showing up, I'm not going to put as many recruiters there as I'm going to put them in other parts of the country. And the other is our bases, as the military's become smaller, we've moved the bases out of the Northeast and the Midwest down to the South and Southwest. So you have a lot of, folks who live near the bases or more or less attracted to the military.
And what about those demographics again in terms of socioeconomic status? As far as volunteers go, they tend to be middle income, low income.
Well, I would say that they're middle income.
Okay.
Basically, but more from rural areas than cities, for example.
And what does that difference does that make?
Well, again, the real question is, and I know you're going to talk to General Leitch later, the real question is, what price do we pay on making sure that the military represents our society as it is?
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't quite do that, but I mean, it's not, in other words, it's not just, the lowest socioeconomic levels. One issue we had, and I remember talking to the Reverend Jackson about this, was that when we went to a volunteer military, you had a lot of African Americans join, and then they reenlisted because the opportunities there were so much better than in society the 70s and the 80s and in the 80s. But I think we've gotten that, basically that has, more or less stabilized, and it's not like you have three times as many African Americans in the force as they are in the population. And interestingly enough, when the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, particularly Iraq, turned out to be fought, in a way that you know, people didn't believe, you know, the government gave the right reasons, and they went on longer than people were led to believe.
Mm-hmm.
Even people from African-American recruitment declined because those, you know, folks had, you know, were not happy about the war. And that has a lot to do with what people join. It's not only the family, it's coaches, ministers, priests, rabbis, who have a great deal to influence on the youngster who might be thinking of joining.
Going forward, to what extent do you think technological development will affect what the military needs in terms of human resources?
Well, you're going to need people, obviously, with higher skills and good education. There's no doubt about that. As you know, people like, you know, some people who might remember World War II, you know, one of the Army recruiters told me, this is not Joe and Willie and the Doughboys anymore here, okay? In other words, yes, you do need people, and that's why the ideal person would be somebody who scores average or above average on the Armed Forces Qualification Test, which is kind of like a College Board type of thing, and with somebody with at least a high school education. So that's what you want. It's becoming more and more technologically sophisticated. But I got to tell you, the volunteer military crumbled during the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan because we had to lower our standards to get people. And we were giving what the Army and the Marines gave 80,000 moral waivers. That is, people who had criminal convictions, which is something you just don't want. I mean, these also included felonies and people who scored, you know, did not score, you know, high enough on the tests. And that has caused tremendous problems. Plus, the career people, or people who were staying in, were deployed more, without enough time at home. When I was there, we set up a rule for every year in a combat zone, at least 2 years at home. We didn't follow that. And that, of course, has led to the problems that you have today with suicides, for example.
Well, Larry, let me ask you what you mean by crumbled, because it looks like it's still out there working. What do you mean by crumbled?
Well,
is a strong word.
Okay. Well, what happened was that when you took in these people who you didn't, you know, have they created problems for us? We can go back in all of the stuff that happened in Iraq, Abu Ghraib. And I'll give you an example. Bradley Manning, or now Chelsea Manning, who shouldn't have been allowed in, flunked out of basic training. We kept him, and you know the problems that that he caused. And then, of course, you had suicides, spousal abuse, all of the problems that were related to the fact that you weren't giving people enough time at home to get themselves ready before they deployed again.
We've been talking with Lawrence Korb. Larry, thank you so much for joining us this hour.
Okay, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Lawrence Corby's former Assistant Secretary of Defense, a senior fellow at American Progress, and a senior advisor to the Center for Defense Information. Coming up, we'll talk about the pros and cons of the volunteer versus conscription, the draft, the lottery, the whole bit, when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. For 40 years, the all-volunteer military has served us, but times are changing. Technology is changing. The ways of war are changing. Some ask whether the human makeup of the military should change as well. Some question whether the volunteer force, military force, worked as well as it should have. Joining us now is the author of Skin in the Game, Poor Kids and Patriots, retired Major General Dennis Leitch. Welcome to the show, General.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Also joining us is OSU military history professor and retired Army Colonel Peter Mansour. Welcome back to the show, Professor Mansour.
Thanks for having me on, Ann.
Dennis, General, in your book, you mentioned that the all-volunteer force widens the gap between the military and the citizens it protects. That's on many levels, I would imagine, but can you tell us in what way the most?
Yeah, there are many people who have written about the fact that there is a civil-military gap that exists in the United States today as a result of the structure of the military since 1973. I was quoted in Time magazine a year or two ago by Mark Thompson in saying that the all-volunteer force is really a mercenary military made up of poor kids and patriots from the third and fourth socioeconomic quintiles of the country, and the first socioeconomic quintile is AWOL. If you look at the composition of the military today, the first socioeconomic quintile, the intelligentsia, and many opinion leaders are absent from that population, and it creates a problem. Just two examples from a political perspective. We had the first national election for president where neither candidate from the two political parties was a military veteran. For the first time in the history of our nation, we have back-to-back chairmen of the House Armed Services Committee who are not military veterans. And this civil-military gap is seen in a whole host of ways.
The family business aspect that was brought up earlier almost sounds nice. And also, Larry Korb said that most the demographics of the defense of at the Pentagon suggests that they're middle class, that they're not from the fourth or third and fourth quintile.
Well, the third, fourth is the is near the middle of the quintile. The first and fourth at the first and fifth quintiles are exempt for different reasons. The first because they have a rich set of alternatives to the military. The last quintile because of high school dropout, or criminal record, or drug problems.
So you're suggesting it's not what there is there, but it's what's not there.
They're both problems. They're both issues, and it's we look oftentimes at the representation of the United States military in the context of race, but not necessarily in the context of socioeconomics.
Professor Mansour, what of that gap? Do you agree there's a gap, and that if there is it a problem?
I agree that the top quintile is not serving in the armed forces to the extent that the middle class is. Our armed forces are not composed of poor kids. It is, by and large, middle class, sons and daughters of middle class families, high school educated, who want to serve. If it's a family business, you know, why is that a problem? They want to serve. They serve voluntarily. They serve knowing that they could go into harm's way. And they get a lot of benefits from it. They get education. The GI Bill is the most generous since the GI Bill that followed World War II. The volunteer military, by and large, is good for America. Now, I agree that the top quintile is not serving. But I'm not sure it's a problem. I mean, it is a problem in the sense that that quintile doesn't feel like they have to serve and defend the United States, that you know, they're good enough to govern, they're good enough to go into the Foreign Service, but not good enough to go into the military. Mm-hmm. And I write about that in my memoir, Baghdad at Sunrise. But I'm not sure forcing them to serve is the answer to the problem.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the personnel makeup of the United States military. We're talking about the volunteer aspect of that. It's all volunteer at this point. Do you think that should change? Do you think it should remain? Give us a call, 614-292-8513. Is there some kind, well, you don't think, Professor Mansour, that something might be missing from the family, the military family, if the best educated, the best informed quintile of the American citizenry is not represented there, except in leadership.
In a perfect world, they would serve in commensurate numbers with the other parts of American society. But look, our military, for most of its existence, has been a volunteer force. The draft is the anomaly, and a draft that actually brings in the upper classes is a true anomaly. You're talking the 1940s and 1950s. Other than that, the upper classes of American society have done a pretty good job evading military service throughout our country's history. And again, I don't think forcing them to serve is going to be the answer to closing any sort of civil military gap that may exist.
General H, are you suggesting that it's an either-or proposition?
Oh,
that
no.
It's either draft or voluntary?
Well,
or...
under almost any set of circumstances, the military would be primarily composed of volunteers. What we have is a set of circumstances, particularly over the past 12 years, where 1% of the American population, disproportionately represented by the third and fourth socioeconomic quintiles, has borne 100% of the burden of these wars along with their families. Oftentimes when I speak on this issue, I ask my audience a hypothetical question. If in 2004 we had had a fair across-the-board draft, no deferments, no exemptions, men and women, and or implemented a war tax such that every quarter every American citizen received a bill for their fair share of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, how long would they have gone on? The entire burden of these wars has been borne by 1% of the population. And I oftentimes wonder if it's an all-volunteer force, why is it that we pay bonuses? For instance, in 2008, 70% of those who enlisted in the Army were paid a bonus. Some people would consider this a bribe. 70%, if it's an all-volunteer force, why do we have to pay a bonus for someone to volunteer when the bonus itself is disproportionately attractive to the economically disadvantaged cohort of our society?
Professor Mansour?
Well, bonuses have been around as long as we've had volunteers joining the military. Even in the 19th century, there were bonuses. So I'm not sure what the issue is there. The fact is that our military did not crumble in the last 10 years. It fought these wars with skill and bravery. It was the most highly trained, most competent military force the world has ever known. And yes, there were some strains on it. But the strains came from the administration's refusal to increase the size of the Army and the Marine Corps to fight the wars that it had brought on the nation, and not because of any endemic faults with the volunteer military itself and the way it was composed. So these wars are winding down now, and the strains will lessen as the combat deployments ease. And the volunteer military will continue to serve as it has since the early 70s. And I believe it's the best system for the United States going forward.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Professor Mansour, you're a historian, but should history be our only guide when we decide whether or not, just because it's always been that way, is that always the way it should be necessarily? Are there any lessons?
No, if you could convince me that somehow we're going to go down a road where the nation is going to fracture as a polity, that the American people literally are going to tear themselves apart because of some sort of lack of service among the elite, then I would opt for something that General H has laid out. But I'm not sure we're going down that road right now.
And then one other thing that General H said that I want to get your response from is the issue of impact on public policy, that how the commander-in-chief and his advisors or her advisors maybe someday make their decisions are affected by the kind of military personnel at hand, right? And that if they had to have instituted a draft and if people had to put their lives on the line, including the top quintile, maybe they would have done something differently.
That perhaps might have been the case in 2004, but I'm not sure it would be the case in 2003 when the war began. There was a lot of the president had a lot of backing of the American people who were very fearful because of the terrorist attacks on the United States. Mm-hmm. President Johnson put ground troops into Vietnam, a war that became highly unpopular. And in 1968, the American people voted in a president who said, we're going to get out. But in 1965, they were overwhelmingly in support of the introduction of ground troops into the Vietnam conflict. So I'm not sure that the existence of a draft is going to change what presidents do in terms of the use of military force.
General H?
Yeah, I just want to go back for a minute and take a look at some of the things that have been done in terms of policy changes and initiatives on the part of the government to support the all-volunteer force concept over these past 12 years of war. The first one is, and Larry Korb alluded to this, is that we violated longstanding policies with regard to dwell time. The longstanding policy was 1 year in combat, 2 years out. We violated that repeatedly. It was not uncommon during the course of these wars to see an active component, soldier or Marine, who had 3, 4, 5 combat tours, and in addition to see reservists or National Guardsmen.
And the reason for those policies are?
We couldn't get enough. We couldn't
recruit
enough.
But the policies...
These are changes that supported the all-volunteer force concept. Mm-hmm. A second one was the use of stop loss, which was highly visible and was seen by many as a backdoor draft. The third one I alluded to already are these the excessive, unprecedented use of enlistment bonuses that in 2008 averaged $18,000. The use of prescription psychotropic drugs to deal with anxiety, depression, and other psychological and emotional issues that faced our soldiers and Marines primarily. As a matter of fact, the Army Times reported in 2010 that 1 out of every 6 soldiers or Marines serving in Iraq and Afghanistan were on some sort of psychotropic drug. Dr. Korb also alluded to the fact that we lowered standards for enlistment, which had devastating and long-term effects. And he referenced the moral rectitude issue, but we also lowered standards for age, education, and physical fitness. We used the National Guard and Reserve in an unprecedented manner that was never anticipated when the all-volunteer force came into effect in 1973. And we also used contractors in an unprecedented format that was never anticipated, with devastating effects, particularly where you had armed military guards.
Professor Mansour, what about the lower standards? You served with a lot of these people, although I think the standards started to really lower after you left, after you retired. But what about that aspect of it, and how do you feel about that?
Well, we lowered the standards to the extent that instead of taking in 100% of volunteers who had high school educations, it was now 90%. The moral waivers, a lot of them were minor drug offenses like the use of marijuana. So the fact is that what we had before the wars of 9/11 was a really highly trained, very well-staffed military, where we could be very choosy about who we brought in. When the wars demanded an increase in the size of the Army and the Marine Corps, which finally came about with Secretary Bob Gates, then we had to bring in some people that we otherwise wouldn't have. But these are hardly the bottom of the barrel. These were still folks who could be trained and who could be made good soldiers and good Marines. And they brought with them an increase in the share of some disciplinary problems, but it wasn't anything that the military couldn't handle. Now, had these wars gone on for another decade, or had they been broader in scope, then I would have been all in favor of some sort of draft and a radical increase in the size of the military to fight them. But the American people were going to have to vote on that and figure out if that's really what they wanted to do. And for these wars, I don't think the American people would have backed it.
That's such a big if, because before we know it, we could be embroiled in something else, and they would just fall back on what's out there right now, and the likelihood of a draft is not very great.
Absent a national emergency that would require vast numbers of troops far beyond what we have in the military service today, the American people will not accept a draft. That's my firm belief. It would be highly inequitable. You would bring in so few numbers that those who would be forced to serve would be feel they were being dealt an unfair blow by the government. And a program that brings in an entire age cohort would be so expensive that we couldn't afford it. So I'm not sure how this would work.
Let's hear from some callers. Jake from Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Jake.
Hi.
You served in Vietnam?
No, actually, I served during the Vietnam era, U.S. Air Force veteran.
Okay. and you wanted to talk about your experience. Were you drafted or?
Actually, I volunteered during the draft.
Okay.
So I volunteered because I was attracted to the GI Bill, which I thought was very generous in the 70s. I was able to get a bachelor's and master's degree paid for in full.
Mm-hmm.
And, I think because I was I was 17 years old out of high school and factories wouldn't hire me, so I went in the military. And I got to be honest with you, at that time, unlike today in retrospect, where I look back and think, wow, that was the best choice I ever made in my lifetime. But back then, as a 17-year-old during a very unpopular war, I don't want to call myself a rebel, but I don't know if the gentleman on the line remember, but there was a palace chase program. I had been active for about 2 years, and in 74, they offered me the palace chase. So I got out because I loved growing my hair long, okay? In the military, you don't grow your hair long, okay? Otherwise, there's disciplinary action. But I took advantage of palace chase, which means you, for every year of active you have remaining, you spend 2 years in the National Guard. So
okay.
When I did that, and this might be a little comical, but I'll share it anyway, but they actually allowed airmen to wear a short-haired wig. So I remember as a weekend warrior,
oh.
I would stuff all my hair in bobby pins under a short-haired wig, and I would get by during the inspection. I mean, you know, it was allowed at that time because Vietnam was winding down, and wanted to serve my country, so I served it out those 4 years with bobby pins under a short-haired wig. But, you know, it was...
Different times.
It was, like I said, at the time, I didn't like being in a unpopular war because mm-hmm. I remember wearing my uniform one day and coming out of a basketball thing, and somebody punched me out because, you know, they just took their frustration out on veterans, okay? But I look back, I'm proud to have been a veteran. I'm proud to have served my country because it really set a very nice foundation for my life.
And what do you think about the idea of a volunteer versus a draft?
Well, again, as the good gentleman said, in time of crisis, I think, you know, the draft would be merited. But I think, you know, having sons myself and daughter, I think at the end of the day, I would love for my children to make their own choice rather than be forced into the situation. Now, again, trusting the powers that be, okay, hey, we need a draft. I mean, I really think if it's merited,
mm-hmm.
right on.
Okay.
But if it's just something, hey, we want to do, you know, I think we really need to reevaluate.
Okay. Thank you, Jake.
Thank you.
Thanks for your call. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. The all-volunteer force has been around since 1973. It's seen its fair share of controversy. It was praised by the country upon its institution, but as time moves on and our wars continue for years on end, there seems to be a new call to assess the effectiveness and viability of this long-standing military force makeup. Still with us to discuss this new assessment is retired Major General Dennis Leitch, who wrote a book on the topic. It's called Skin in the Game, Poor Kids and Patriots. Also still with us is Associate Professor of Military History at OSU and also retired former assistant.
Retired Army Colonel.
Thank you, Pete Mansour. Sorry about that, Professor Mansour. Let's talk about, I want to get to some of the calls, so hang in there, callers. Let's talk about we hear a lot more now, not that it didn't occur after the Vietnam War, but we hear a lot more now about things like PTSD and all of the emotional and ramifications of serving in the way that you serve with this kind of a constant return to action. You're saying, General Leitch, that it's worse with an all-volunteer force. Why is that?
Well, I don't say it's necessarily worse with an all-volunteer force, but some of the things that we've done to support the all-volunteer concept during the last 12 years, most critically, the repeat deployments and the violation of longstanding dwell time policies, the use of psychotropic drugs to deal with depression, anxiety, et cetera, have contributed to and exacerbated some of these issues that have been historically the outcomes of war.
How so?
Well, it, for instance, if you have there's a pretty compelling body of knowledge out there, that there are research out there that says that the PTSD is more likely to occur and to be more intense as a result of second or third tours. It's almost a logical outcome. When we look at the use of psychotropic drugs to deal with anxiety, stress, et cetera, drugs like Seroquel, Valium, Ambien, Respidol, that frankly, the Federal Aviation Administration will not allow pilots to fly with, and we give them to soldiers and Marines over extended periods. We exaggerate some of these problems, and PTSD leads to many of the things that we now wring our hands over as citizens: homelessness, unemployment, domestic violence, crime on the part of veterans, a suicide crisis, ongoing drug abuse and alcohol abuse after separation from the service, a huge VA backlog that peaked out 2 years ago at 902,000 cases, and a whole host of social and emotional issues for soldiers.
It sounds like a lot of that, though, is the consequence of something that Professor Mansour brought up earlier, which was a lack of preparedness. They weren't prepared for a war that they started, and now we're
Remember that this war went on for 12 years. Mm-hmm. We're still in the war in Afghanistan. So there was which was more than ample time to make adjustments in policies. But the adjustments we made in many cases led to some of these consequences.
Professor Mansour?
Yeah, I would agree. The lack of will of the first Bush administration, at least, to increase the size of the military led to repeat deployments. And the incidence of PTSD is more pronounced in those people who have prolonged exposure to combat, and especially if that combat is violent combat. Of course, if you're a logistician on a base and you have the occasional mortar round, it's not going to be as prevalent as those people in the infantry. But our rates of PTSD in these wars are not significantly above what they were in Vietnam. And we don't have good data for previous wars because we hadn't diagnosed the syndrome back in World War II and before then. So I'm not sure that these wars have led to an epidemic in PTSD that didn't exist in previous wars.
To what extent do you think was the return experience different, or whether it mattered? With the Vietnam War, during the draft, you served your time and then came back, and you were very isolated. It's not like you came back with a group of people. You came back pretty much on your own. In the case of the last wars, the current war, it's been an issue of repeat deployment has been more of the issue, where you keep going back over and over again. It seems like it's two sides of the same coin.
Well, there were plenty of people in Vietnam who had two and three tours. The volunteers who
right.
continued to go back. So the draftees, yes, they were one and done, but others not. And when you come back now with your unit, because we have unit rotations, mm-hmm. there's a lot more
support
for them back at their home bases, support for their families while they're deployed. And again, I'm not sure we tend to paint the entire military with a broad brush, but the number of people with PTSD is a fraction of the total who served.
Well, there's some pretty broadly based studies that say that the total number of vets from Iraq and Afghanistan, the percentage of PTSD cases approaches 20% to 30%. There are a number of studies out there that might be a little bit high, but the fact of the matter is that PTSD in these wars is a major issue, and I make a reference to it in the book and with repeat deployments, that no horse is so dead that it can't be beaten one more time.
Steve, in Columbus, you're on the air. You were drafted to serve in the Vietnam War.
Yes, I was a conscientious objector that served in as a noncombatant.
Okay.
And there are two things I think that, first of all, I'd just like to say that I think that the professor's comments I disagree with some of them because I don't think they're factual. For instance, the upper classes have participated in all major wars and conflicts in history in the United States, with the exception of this Afghanistan war and the Gulf War, because we had a professional army. And so that's just not right. It's true that other lower classes disproportionately serve, but all you have to do is just open up any history book or read any of Stephen Ambrose's book if you need something a little more popular, and you'll see the numbers and the stories. But what I definitely agree with your guest who says that the burden should be shared. And you can look at it from just a moral standpoint, and it's grossly unfair to expect, you know, all these soldiers from, and it was really true during the Vietnam War too, from the South, from poor backgrounds, from inner cities, to serve and suffer and die in combat very disproportionately. It's morally wrong. But if people don't really pay much attention to moral arguments anymore, really, that's what got us out of Vietnam. But if you look at the social and the fiscal problems of a professional army, and you listen to Robert Gates, in one of the last speeches he gave, he warned everybody. It was like the speech that Eisenhower gave, you know, on the military-industrial complex, but it's a little bit different. We have voted unsustainable veterans benefits to a mercenary army. It's just ridiculous. We can't, and we never will be able to support that as a society. And so they reckoning is coming, to quote General Schwarzkopf, and we're going to have to cut those benefits. We're going to have to, cut back on our forces. The other is the social impact. I have a relative who's fighting in Afghanistan right now. He's leading a platoon, mm-hmm. and he's risking his life every day. He's in the Rangers. I learned a little bit about the culture that he's in. It's quite different from American culture. It's very conservative, and it's somewhat kind of an enclave culture, wherever the bases are. That's not good for the military, not good for America. And we would never get into these military ventures if everybody had to share the burden, and especially if the politicians' sons and daughters were exposed to the dangers. So,
all right,
said my piece.
Yeah, all right, Steve, thanks for your piece.
Sure.
Let's talk about the cost and what he referred to as far as
Let me talk
Secretary
about something
Gates.
Else first.
Yep. Okay.
I went to West Point in 1978 out of high school. I served 26 years in the military to serve my country. And yes, I got an education out of it and some great experiences. I met my wife on a military tour, and I served proudly. I really resent being called a mercenary by anyone. Now, regarding the cost, if you look at the total percentage of the gross domestic product that's gone into the military, it peaked in World War II, because it was, of course, a total war, at about 45% of the GDP. It dropped after the war. It went back up to 17% during the Korean War. It dropped again, went back up to about 6% during Vietnam, dropped again, went back up to about 4% during the Reagan defense buildup, dropped a little bit during the peace dividend of the Clinton years, and it's back up to about 4% of the GDP. 4% of the GDP is not an excessive amount to ensure the national security of the United States, and it's an amount this nation can afford. It's not like these veterans' benefits and the cost of the volunteer military is breaking the bank. If you want to see what's breaking the bank, take a look at the growth of entitlement spending in the civilian sector from 2% in the 1960s to 13% of the GDP today. That's what's breaking the bank. So I don't think it's that the cost of the military is excessive, and it's a matter of whether we want to be protected or not.
It's a matter of priorities.
I think that there's another way to look at this. The fact of the matter is that in the last decade, personnel costs in the military have risen 46%. When the Gates Commission did their analysis in the early 70s, they recognized that pay and benefits were going to have to increase dramatically in order to attract people into the military. And the other data point that I think is relevant is that Secretary Panetta said a few years ago that if personnel costs continue to rise at the rate at which they do now, by the year 2039, assuming just an increase equal to inflation for the overall defense budget, personnel costs will consume the entire defense budget by 2039. And I should point out one other thing. The U.S. defense budget is greater than the defense budget of the next 14 nations in the world combined.
Let's talk about that, the idea that they'll just run out of money at the Pentagon if they keep paying out all of the, you know, for the retirees and the pensions and the VA benefits
and the active forces. It's true that the personnel budget is consuming more and more. A lot of that is because of health care spending, and that's a nationwide problem, not just in the military.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to deal with that by basically forcing people to serve in the military and then paying them less than what you're paying soldiers now, then that's a national decision that's going to have to be decided on fiscal merits. But I hear different arguments for the draft of closing the civil military gap, forcing the top quintile to serve, and then all of a sudden it's coming down to dollars and cents. So I'm not sure what it is here.
Michael in Columbus, you're on the air. We have a couple minutes. Well, just about 1 minute.
Okay. Hey, thank you. I was a combat Marine in Vietnam, and it just seems to me like we're either or. You know, I think that probably an all-volunteer army is made for a semi-stable world and to hit a troubled spot like Bosnia. It's not made for a prolonged engagement. And if we can't be honest about that, if we're going to go into prolonged engagement and not invite the whole country to partake in that through taxes and effort, I don't think it's very fair to ask 1% of the population to serve in the wars for 10 or 12 years.
How do you do that, though? Michael, and we really are running out of time, but I'm getting the looks. But how do you know you're going into a long-term war? I mean, how do you ever know that?
Well, I liked how President Johnson said. He says it's much easier to it's much harder to put the pin in the grenade after it's out. But once you cross, you can't determine what a war is
right
when you go into it. But I think responding to a situation in the world and a crisis in the world is different than creating a crisis in the world. Hmm. And usually when you create a crisis in the world, it's a prolonged situation from my observation.
Okay. Michael, thank you so much for your call. We have just about 30 seconds each. General Laich.
For a final comment?
Yes.
Yeah, I just make one comment here. And the question is the all-volunteer force working and will it work in the future? And the question for you and your audience is this. Are we willing as a nation to go into the next war and deliver these same consequences onto those who fight it and their families, assuming that someone shows up to fight it? What are the moral and physical national security consequences of ignoring the shortcomings and failures of the all-volunteer force concept? This is a dialogue that we all should engage in, and I appreciate the fact that you facilitated this with your audience today.
I appreciate you being with us, General Laich. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Professor Mansour?
Well, I appreciate General Laich and his book. I think everyone should read it. It's a wonderful think piece, and this is something we should debate. I'm a supporter of the all-volunteer force. I think it's working. But I agree that if we're going to go into sustained conflicts in the years ahead, then we need to rethink the concept. But it doesn't look like we are.
Thank you so much for joining us today. It's Professor Peter Mansour, Associate Professor of Military History at OSU and a retired Army colonel, and also Dennis Leitch. He's a retired Major General and author of the book Skin in the Game, Poor Kids and Patriots. Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurevich, assistant producer Rachel Quimby, production assistants from Olivia Rojas, Justin English, Emmy Beach, Julia Hyder, and Leticia Wiggins. Justin English produced this show with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Thanks so much for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.